Anyway.
Apologies. I didn't mean to dominate the conversation.
Well, you know what? There's no you or me to dominate any conversation. And so the fact that you take credit for it is just another one of those crazy ironies. I'm not even here, and I'm taking credit for everything. So, good morning, Bruce.
Good.
All right. So it looks like they've got
to go?
Ready to go. Yep. And welcome to the House of the Rising Sun. And we are the Rising Sun. And I'm very happy this morning. And we had some snow here yesterday, which I'm sure you missed.
I heard.
Just like, but this is good snow because it brings a lot of moisture and is good for the spring. And I wish I had planted my peas on St. Patrick's Day like I usually do, because they would have gotten all this free moisture. So that's just the way it goes.
Yeah, on St. Patrick's Day, I was wearing a green shirt and walked down to the local nursery to buy some green tape to tie up a green bush that had dropped down onto the green lawn and to tie it up to a tree so that it could continue to stay green. That seemed appropriate, I guess, with
the
context of dream customs.
It's so funny because we have a couple guys that come on here, and you know them. They call themselves the voice from the real world, Rich and Larry. And they were here on St. Patrick's Day, and they were saying, well, you know, there's only a couple of mentions of the word green in the course, and you know, they have to do generally with something to do with nature, but there's one that doesn't have to do with nature, and it just happens that it was the lesson the day before, which would have been St. Patrick's Day if it hadn't been a leap year, which I was really surprised. I'm like, oh, the only time they mentioned green is on St. Patrick's Day.
Well, now you got my curiosity up. I've got to find where that is.
Lesson 76, and it has to do with when you see it, you'll be, oh yeah, of course.
I've been doing them, so I'm just going to back up a couple here and let's see. Oh, green paper strips and piles of metal decks. Of course, that's the one. Yes, yes, the classic spoof of our investment in surreality. Yeah. And magic, of course.
Magic. Oh my gosh. Talk about magic.
So how about?
Go ahead. What are you
going to? Go ahead.
I
was just going to suggest. We're doing Chip and Dale here. I was just going to suggest question 1097 would be a good one. Only because that's close to where I'm at, and it's not one of the super short ones.
All right, so let me go find it and put a link in the room so that people can. I always forget to get the frequently asked questions up before we start. I don't know what I'm doing on Saturday morning instead of that, but
we probably should email each other so we can jump right into it and folks can get right into it, huh? not that our preliminary patter is anything wrong with it, of course, but
no, and all that, you know, that's what I've been seeing is all the, you know, I'm a planner, and I just, you know, have realized how ridiculous all my planning is. And yet, you know, I still continue to do it. My husband came home the other, well, I think I told you that my husband is getting laid off, the last of April. And so, you know, even now I'm downstairs making coffee and thinking, you know, I ought to use this kind of coffee creamer and save this for when we don't have any money. And, I'm already planning to be broke. Isn't that crazy?
It sounds like a green paper strip metal disc magic mental exercise to me. I've gone through it a few times.
Well, you go through it until you figure out there's no point to it. And then when you figure out
there's no point to it,
then you do the right thing, which is, in fact, I spend like the last hour when I don't usually sleep past like 5 o'clock in the morning. And of course, it's 7 o'clock here now. So gives me kind of a chance to meditate on Saturday morning because I wake up so early. And what I found myself really doing was that chapter 5 decision for God about all this, all these fears, all these ideas that something can go wrong. And it's pretty amazing when you look at all the ways in which you think that things have gone wrong or could have gone wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me.
Because we think our problems are different, which kind of ties in today's workbook lesson, you know, which I read a couple hours ago when I woke up and then fell back asleep. You know, let me recognize the problem so it can be solved. We think all our problems are different. You know, your problem might be, you know, dreading, you know, an economic situation when your husband's layoff is complete. Mine might be, you know, thinking, oh, I got to, you know, get this project done by a certain time or I need to, you know, handle X, Y, or Z. And, you know, we all have our, like you say, our plans and our lists but they're all, you know, centered around the belief that we're this specific person and in a specific world that the Course tells us doesn't exist. So by deduction, then that means this specific self and its body are just, you know, a game that we play to keep ourselves in a state of fear, you know, and wow, what a complex hoax.
But we
need to address it from the level that we think we're at, and that's why I think forgiveness is such an important thing, is because if we can forgive each specific issue and phobia and realize that we've been through them all and we're still here, not, you know, maybe the form has changed, but the content is always that decision-making faculty.
Exactly. And the thing that is so important that people don't seem to get, and of course I didn't seem to get so for quite a while, was I would be forgiving the idea that my husband was going to lose his job and we were going to be broke. I'd be forgiving you know, my fear about that. But I wouldn't be looking at all the little fears that went around with it, like which coffee creamer will I be able to use? Or, you know, how should I save up this or keep that or do this or do that? And every single one of those thoughts is a contributor to the entire mountain.
Yeah.
So you have to take out every single one of those thoughts has to be addressed.
Right.
It can't just
right.
be lump sum addressed like, oh, I'm not afraid my husband's going to lose his job now. It's like, oh, I'm not afraid I'm going to lose my coffee creamer. I'm not afraid that, you know, these are the things that are the foundation of the illusion. And every single one of them, when you go down to looking at it, you're going to find that you're feeling that there's guilt involved in all of it. And, for instance, the coffee creamer, because the first thing I thought after I thought that was, well, that wouldn't be fair to everyone else if, you know, I was able to save the kind of coffee creamer I like and not, you know, not everybody else gets to have it or, you know, I'm being selfish here. Honest to God, this.
No, I'm not laughing at you. I'm laughing with you because because we all have these, you know, from above the battleground, these silly things that we fret over, and you know, they're just crazy from you know a sane perspective, and I think that's where the Course's perspective is so. Both gentle and completely patient, as well as uncompromising, and then you know, like you say, we have to be willing eventually, and we can do it at our own pace, whatever you know is comfortable to us. It's because it's a voluntary time frame, but the curriculum is set, you know, the curriculum is the generality of forgiving everything. Because unless we release our mental white-knuckled grip on the steering wheel of ego's attempt to try to fix the dream in every respect and use every single thing that crosses our mind ultimately as a forgiveness opportunity, then we're saying, yeah, I still have a little investment in this tiny mad idea. And I still want to try to make the dream work. And I don't think very many people are, you know, there yet. Well, of course, they wouldn't think of themselves as people, but, and so the course addresses where we think we're at. We think we're people. We think we're individuals separated, you know, separated out from perfect oneness. If we even contemplate perfect oneness, which we really don't most of the time, right? But we have that longing to remember the peace and the innocence and the ineffable joy that we never left. And so that's why we're drawn to things like A Course in Miracles and why, to me, when I found it, you know, and not 3 decades ago, it's like, wow, there's just so much concentrated wisdom here that reminds me that it's all the same thing. You know, we really have to, you know, embrace a non-dual perspective if we want to free ourselves from the entanglement of ego's total insanity thinking that there's the differences are important, that green paper strips and metal discs and fluids push through a needle into a vein and for tablets that are put into the mouth of a body that we think is different from other bodies and all this stuff.
The insanity of it is that people will start like I did, like you did, I'm sure we all did, and we went through and said, oh, forgiveness is good and great, and yet you know, when we didn't, after the first couple of years, you know, find that peace of God that we were being promised, then, you know, we said, well, this thing doesn't work, or it doesn't work the way I thought it did, or we were expecting some magical cure, uh-huh, and not realizing that, you know, when Jesus says you got to forgive everything, he means everything. Uh-huh. And so what is holding us back is our reluctance, right, to let go of our favorite things, the things that we whether it's a grievance, like, oh, I hate Donald Trump, and I'm going to, you know, keep nagging on that until long after the election, and if he gets elected, even more. Or, you know, I want this specific kind of coffee creamer.
Yeah. I'm going to use a specific example. I'm right now, since I noticed I have a half empty glass in front of me, and I keep these little, a little box of vitamin packets, in front of me, which I just ripped a little tinfoil pouch open and poured it in a glass and emptied took the empty packet and put it in a little green metal can. Speaking of green. And so I was just noticing everything's a perfect example. I'm not going to necessarily stop doing that, you know, because I have a preference for, you know, thinking in my mind that this body that I call Bruce has, you know, need for a certain amount of vitamins every day. So I'll probably keep doing that. But if I can look at it and not take it quite so seriously and say, oh yeah, here's part of the dream of values and of a special interest that this seeming person has, and if I can use that and everything else during the day, and that's why Ken Wapnick says this is such a difficult curriculum. Not that it isn't, it's not that it's complex. It's infinitely simple. It basically, the simplicity of it is, it says take everything that involves space, time, individuality, and the outer shield of oblivion, anything that's, you know, matter and energy based, anything that's time and space based, anything that has to do with the material world as we think of it, and allow that to become a classroom for looking at the inner shield of oblivion, which is ego's equally made up world of sin, guilt, fear, and death, which doesn't even require any of those physical things, but is based on this unimaginably vast guilt complex of believing that we shattered perfect oneness. And Ken Wapnick goes into that in the, you know, when he talks about the four splits, and I've got a book on that that's that's moving up closer to my reading list that I got when the Foundation for A Course in Miracles had a book sale last year, and I'm looking forward to reading it. And I know there's audio tapes on that too, but the basic idea being that, you know, we think we shattered perfect oneness, and so we think we're here in this incredibly complex dream and so invested in it that we've forgotten that, you know, we've just strapped ourselves into a vehicle and adopted a role and so identified with it and gotten into character that we think this is the real deal. I mean, how crazy is that? And I think that's the brilliance of A Course in Miracles, that it at every turn in countless ways keeps pointing that out and showing us the stark contrast between the insanity of the ego that thinks it's shattered perfect oneness and the gentle, calm, peaceful sanity of what the Course calls the Holy Spirit's voice, you know, our inner kindness teacher, I like to call it, that we all took with us into the dream that said, nothing happened. You're okay. Everything's fine. Everyone's fine. But we in order to remember that, we need to use all the specifics, whether it's, you know, ripping open a vitamin packet or thinking about coffee creamer or, you know, use every little specific that crosses our mind. And as a mechanism for self-forgiveness, and that self-forgiveness obviously has to include forgiving every seeming other, whether it's a politician with orangutan colored hair on the TV screen or someone else of a party we like or don't like, or whether it's in news about refugees or plagues or, you know, weather calamities or just countless things. I mean, the world is so loaded with things that are just designed to taunt us and tease us and say, yeah, I know you're going to fall for this one. You're going to get sucked into this and be angry or depressed or discouraged or resentful or jealous or, you know, any of those emotions that separate us, and there are countless of those, are candidates for our forgiveness classroom, aren't they?
Absolutely. And that's why if you look at the introduction to the course in, to the workbook, what does he say here? He says transfer of training in true perception does not proceed as does transfer of the training of the world. If true perception has been achieved in connection with any person, situation, or event, total transfer to everyone and everything is certain. On the other hand, one exception held apart from true perception makes its accomplishments anywhere impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
It's all inclusive,
huh?
It's all inclusive. It's either all or nothing. And if you leave anything out, if you say, well, you know, for instance, smoking. I smoke. I don't smoke, but because I would be a total wreck if I did. But, you know, I smoke and I enjoy smoking, but I know smoking's bad, and smoking is bad for me and it's bad for everybody around me, and it costs money. And look at all the guilt that goes into the idea of smoking. And I know people who smoke who are just racked with guilt because of it, but they're so compelled to keep doing it because that's the way the ego system is set up, is to make you addicted to something that is totally heinous. And then.
But see, there's no stigma about oxygen, and I'm a total addict when it comes to oxygen. So.
Well, exactly.
It's all about culturally approved stigmas, right? Yeah.
And but there is, you know what? Because I'll tell you what, not the oxygen, but you know, if you go out shopping or go, and no, this is not a recording, Igor, this is live. If you go out, say for instance, to the grocery store, and the first thing when you walk in the grocery store, generally nowadays they have a little stand with a thing of wet wipe things that you can wipe off your cart, because you know the person that had that cart before me probably had the plague, and now I'm going to be touching this thing that they touched, and now I'm going to be making myself sick and everybody else. So to protect myself, I got to have this, you know, wipe this thing down. And then oh my gosh, then if you're standing next to me in the line and you're coughing or sneezing, you're attacking me. I'm being attacked everywhere. And so even the oxygen, the air that you're breathing, where the oxygen may not be bad, all the other things that are in it. I mean, look at the chemtrails. Look at the...
Oh, don't get me started. Well, of course, there's nothing wrong with doing what we can to prevent the spread of contagion within the belief systems that we have. But the question that we have to keep asking ourselves is, what is there that could be possibly damaged by contagion? What, you know, what is it that's vulnerable? What is it that is at the mercy of something else? Well, it can only be a dualistic thing, right? It can only be something that is capable of being attacked from something outside itself, which right off the bat says, okay, there's space-time, there's energy, the whole energy-matter matrix of stuff that seems to be divided from other stuff, you know, to use George Carlin's word. You know, but the stuff is all based on the belief that separate interests were possible and therefore gave rise to separate forms. And if that's the case, then all bets are off. You know, when we're talking about all-inclusive, I had a fun experience yesterday. Some of you probably know about the conference in Las Vegas, the Course in Miracles conference that the Community Miracle Center puts on in Las Vegas, and the previous ones were in New York and Chicago, and I've actually attended a couple in San Francisco, and I know they had some there before that too. So this next one is coming up in a few weeks in Las Vegas, and so there was the Miracle Share folks, Craig and Danielle and Corinne had a little contest that they were giving away a free ticket. So I thought, oh, what the heck? I'll put my email address in there, and they emailed me and said, hey, you won it. So I thought, cool. So I'm going.
Yay! I'm going too.
Oh, good. I'll see you there. Excellent.
Yes.
Fun. Well, whoever's there, I'll look forward to seeing you as well.
Oh, you know what? This is there's a purpose behind this. I can tell.
Oh, yeah. So anyway, but so that's kind of fun. So I think, yeah, okay, that'll be fun. Because I kind of wanted to go, but I was kind of, you know, because you mentioned earlier, like, the price. I said, well, that's a little pricey. Well, but it's fun to see everyone, you know, and it's a great social event. And so, you know, that makes three conferences and retreats of different kinds happening in the next 3 months or so, counting the one in Colorado Springs that Lynn Corona and Tim Wise are doing in May, and then the one that I'll be at in Estes Park in June. And I know you mentioned Regina will be there, and Gary and Renard and Cindy Lurie will all be there. So anyway, what brought this up to mind, though, was with the inclusive thing, because I was thinking, well, the ticket that I won includes the meals, but it doesn't include the travel and the lodging. So
right.
I got that arranged, and I actually found some pretty good deals on that. But I was thinking, well, there's nothing that's really all-inclusive about ego's thought system. There's always something. You know, as Rosanna Dennis said, it's always something. Because we want to exclude, but we're not consciously aware that we wanted to exclude, because the belief in separation and the desire to divide and to fragment and to shatter, that original idea of the tiny mad idea, which, you know, physics sort of calls the equivalent idea on the level of form, the Big Bang, is so far removed from our everyday experience that we you know, don't really think about that much. But I think we can kind of get back to that primal oops that never happened, you know, to use Ken's phrase, you know, by looking at the maladaptive solution to the non-existent problem. I think if we look at the solution that ego puts forth, which is, oh, I've got to fix the dream. I got to, you know, go through my list of things I got to do and stuff I need to worry about and yada, yada. And use everything as a forgiveness classroom. That then brings our mind back to the mindful state where we can see that it's all the same. And that sameness then leads to the oneness. And I think we talked about this reading one of the FAQs a few weeks ago, how the sameness is a wonderful, ideal, classroom that leads us back to the oneness that we can't really even fathom here.
Exactly. And so that's why you have to look at every single thing, and you can't exclude anything. You can't leave anything out. You have to look at every single thing, every single thought, and not analyze it, not say, oh, let me see how these two things are the same. Not analyze it and say, let me see how I'm thinking these things are different. All you have to do is do the forgiveness process.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, I must have decided wrongly. I'm not at peace. and recognize that you're not at peace, because otherwise you wouldn't be evaluating and measuring and you know, trying to figure out which is which and which is good and which is bad. And you wouldn't be comparing. You wouldn't be doing any of those things if you were at peace. So anytime I'm doing those things, I recognize immediately now that I'm not at peace. I used to just think it was normal and be, you know, in that general unease and think that everyone, you know, that's just normal, or that I'm the only one who thinks this way, but never recognize that it's not normal to be at unease, to be worried about, am I right or wrong? Am I making the right choice? Is this what I should do? None of those things. So then say, I'm not at peace, and I did this myself. You know, I was the one who made the choice, and I can choose again.
Yeah.
And what I'm doing now is I'm not deciding what to choose now. I am turning it over to the Holy Spirit.
That's the only choice that makes sense, does it?
Yes.
Because all the choices among illusions, of which there seem to be an endless number, are just choosing illusion A over illusion B over illusion C, and none of those restore the peace that we think we lost. And to emphasize what you just shared with, which I thought was great, is that the choices that we think we're making, you know, the only real choice is the one that says I could see peace instead of this, and you know, that's a big choice that really helped. Should we get to the reading?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And let me post in the room so that, and which one are we looking at now, did you say?
I was suggesting 1097.
1097, okay.
It's about five paragraphs, and that's probably something we could get through in about half
an
hour.
All right. Yeah. you're noticing that we kind of take our time with this stuff.
Oh, so, okay.
And it's good. It's, you know, it's perfect, because this is how we get there.
Yeah.
So this is, and so if you're looking, I just posted the, in the room where it is, and it is, and let me just actually click on the thing itself.
So while you're doing that, I'll just put a little aside promotion for another wonderful resource online, and that's Susan Dugan's website, which is foraysinforgiveness.com. And what reminded me is, you know, that everything, kind of how we were, you know, taking our time this first half hour building up to reading the lesson. And I think that's a style that Susan uses in her writing, which I find really engaging and fun, of basically taking the specifics of what's going on in her forgiveness classroom and, you know, basically writing about those for a number of paragraphs with the ever-increasing awareness to kind of describe the style of her writing with you know, ever increasing awareness of the idea that, oh yeah, I could be using this as a classroom.
Yeah.
And then by the end of each essay, she's returned to that awareness. So each essay is sort of a miniature odyssey from the ego back to the Holy Spirit. And I think that's what is you know, the metaphor that we're all using here. And that's why I enjoy her writing so much, because not only is it fun, and she kind of pokes gentle fun of her ego's techniques, and in a way that we can all relate to. You know, it's basically a way of saying, oh, I can use the specific that seems to be happening right now, and like Ken Wapening said one of his audios I was listening to the other day, and during this lecture he mentioned specific times. He says now at 2:17, and a few minutes later he says now at 2:34 I could be choosing peace instead of this, you know, and you know, things like that, and he goes on. But you know, that's the thing, is to gradually over time, because we think there's time, choose against ego's strategy. And for the peace that's beyond that. And so, should I start with the?
Yeah, why don't you start the reading? And
okay.
We'll why don't you read the question and the first part of the first paragraph of the answer?
Okay, all right. Question 1097. This is from facimoutreach.org. And it's the next to last batch of questions, I believe. It's, if you go to /QA/questions/questions227.htm, you'll get there directly with the facmoutreach.org and the preface there. So it goes, question 1097, what is love? A Course in Miracles says we can't understand love on this side of the fence, and that we must only seek and find all the blocks to love's presence that we have built within us. And then it references chapter 16, section 4, paragraph 6, sentence 1. So, what is love? Well, there's that open-ended question now. And here's the first the answer. The paragraph that starts off the answer begins with, the situation is this. Our experience is that we are individuals living, in a finite physical universe. But we experience that as our reality only to the extent that we are, in the present, choosing to be separate from our true identity in God, who is love. So, yeah, right off the bat, we're using incredible mental prowess and capacity for projecting a hologram and making up a dream that's so convincing and so real that we've almost completely identified with it. So, but that's what the Course suggests that we can undo. And even though it seems, you know, stupendous and preposterous to suggest that, it really is our true nature to undo it. So.
Oh, and also I just wanted to say right away when you read this, choosing to be separate from our true identity in God, who is love.
Mm-hmm.
The first, I immediately felt guilty.
Yeah. Well, of course. Why would we do that? Well, the truth of it is we didn't, but we only get to that aha, that ineffable, magically, well, more than, not the ego's magical, but truly wonderful aha moment of realizing that nothing happened if we look at it. And that's why the ego is so terrified of looking with Holy Spirit, you know, because it's like, oh, look it with me and I'll make sure you look at the barriers and see how huge and massive the big granite boulders are in front of the way of love's presence, you know. Well, because there's no love, you know, there's nothing there. No, trust me. You know, yeah, says the ego, right? But it's a smokescreen. It's actually just a flimsy veil, you know. It's like a cloud, as one of the places in the Course describes. You know, a feather or a penny could fall through it with nothing stopping it. But we've built it into this massive lead brick, whatever, you know, barrier that's impenetrable in our minds only. But because even matter, as we, you know, understand it now with physics, is mostly empty space. It's there's nothing here, folks. Nothing here in ego's dream world, anyway. Okay, how then can we understand what love is if we are choosing not to be part of it? Ah, so it's intentional. That, in essence, is why our spiritual journey must be centered on identifying and then undoing the blocks we have constructed and are upholding in the present to keep ourselves apart from love. So we made it up. We made up these blocks, and the blocks are the whole matrix of space, time, and the whole mesmerizing dream so enthralling that keeps us identified with separate selves that have separate needs and demand constant attention. Feed me, feed me. Okay, do you want to read the next paragraph, Lynn?
Sure, so just we're thinking now about the undoing the blocks that we have constructed, and so that's what I've begun to really look at. Of course, you know, I've been trying to do that for a long time, but when I've been looking at the blocks, I've been looking at, you know, what I thought were big things, big blocks, and not looking at all the little blocks that are just like so subtle and so, I mean, seriously, you know, if you're not paying attention, they will trip you because you'll be believing one or the other is true and or necessary. And when you believe that one or the other is true or necessary, you automatically put yourself in a place where you're going to be tripped up by it.
Yeah.
So just recognizing that everything you think the world is, everything you think society is, everything you think that is expected of you, everything that you expect, every single one of those things is one of those blocks.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think you know, I should be able to do all these lessons in a year and become enlightened. That in itself is a block.
Right.
You know, you've already put something up there that is going to make it absolutely certain that you'll never achieve your goal.
Yeah. And as you're saying blocks, I was thinking how they're actually nothing. I was just flashing on a shape that some people might be familiar with. It's called a Menger sponge. And that's basically a block that has holes in it. And then as you look more carefully, you realize that each of the remaining things that seem to be solid that make it up, each of those has holes in it, and it's a fractal, if for those who are familiar with fractals. So if you keep looking more carefully, the farther down you drill, pun intended, into this seemingly solid object, the more you realize there's nothing there. And I think that's metaphorically when we start looking at ego's insanity, we realize that in retrospect, I think that sometimes can be helpful. If we look at the things that we thought were horribly challenging, that, you know, when we were a kid or an adolescent, just for example, you know, we say, well, those weren't big deals, but they sure seemed like it, you know. But if we look honestly at those circumstances and events, we realize, well, gee, you know, I made it through that. I mean, so what's the big deal? But then we forget to apply it to our current circumstances, which we still maintain are big deals. They're still effective propaganda that ego is using against our peace. And we're saying, oh, I still want that anxiety or that dread or that depression or that anger or whatever, you know, whatever it is that we feel is our righteous, justified upset, our grievances, you know, that as long as one of those is in place, the ego's fat, dumb, and miserable.
Yeah. Well, and also, here's another thing that I think has really been putting itself in my face a lot, because part of my MO, and probably a lot of other people, part of our MO, is that I look at other people and I see them in the same situation that I would be in or I've been in, and I imagine, I project that their suffering is much worse than mine is, and that somehow or the other, how are they going to make it through this? And you know, it just breaks my heart to see it. And what I've begun, and that's been a major block for me, is feeling compassion. Is what, you know, the world would call it, empathy, compassion, whatever, which empathy is a big trip here. But feeling that for other people, thinking that they are in a situation that they will not be able to recover from, and that somehow or the other, now I'm suffering for them because I'm feeling bad. For instance, you know, I just want to throw in, you know, some solid examples. So you may look at this in your own thinking as well. when I see a mother who's lost a child, and, you know, I'm projecting all misery, sorrow, fear, upset, you know, all these things onto this person. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at them and I'm feeling sorry for them and feeling sad about their situation. And it's hurting my heart even to think about it. When in reality, they are the Son of God, the Holy Son of God, who cannot lose or have lost anything. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm looking at is not the Holy Son of God. This is when Jesus says to have all, give all to all, a big part of what he's saying is give them the respect of being the Christ, who is not being affected by their circumstance.
Right.
And if I'm imagining they're being affected by their circumstance to the point where they are, I have to feel sad and anguished for them, then I'm just not seeing them as the Christ. And I know this, I mean, this is kind of off the topic, but in reality, if I can't look at my brother and give them the credit for having learned how to ride their bike without me holding on to the back of their seat so they don't fall over, and they're a grown-up person and I'm still assisting them, that I don't have the faith in them, and I'm not seeing them as I want to see myself, and I'm not seeing us as the Christ. So these obstacles, these blocks, are not just the block that's keeping me from being able to move. It's also keeping me from being able to see my brother as whole. And I know it, again, it sounds kind of off the wall, but when I realize that a big portion of my suffering has to do with imagining other people suffering,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and not seeing them as being the Christ who is beyond suffering. And so I'm over here causing myself, you know, I'm going out of my way to do things and to try to make up for the guilt I feel for not having lost a child, for not being in their shoes or whatever. It's so complex.
Guilt strikes from ego's thought system, regardless of whether we have or don't have. It basically has nothing to do with the form. It's always about the content of the mind that says that the separation happened. And so, and then the mechanisms, whether, you know, you appear to be victim or victimizer, have or have not, doesn't matter. It's the same fake story. It's the same lie that ego puts out. And that doesn't mean that we, you know, should withhold, you know, compassion and caring and all those things. In fact, it really suggests that we do them with a greater depth that can really be truly healing for ourselves and the alleged others in our lives, because we're no longer invested in the outcome. We can afford to you know, say something that is going to be helpful. One of Ken's stories I thought was really interesting, where he talked about, I think it was it Freud or Jung or one of those. I think it might have been Freud, or maybe it was Ken himself. Anyway, it was a story about someone who, you know, was elderly and ill and you know, basically. This person, I think maybe it was Ken. I'm going to get my stories mixed up. But, you know, wanted to see this person and provide them with a little help, you know. And so they tried all kinds of things from the course and that sort of thing. And finally, this elderly woman said, I just want you to read to me from the Bible. And it was not something that I guess it was Ken, that, you know, that he realized that in order for her to find the healing, he had to go along with that form. And I'm kind of, you know, paraphrasing the story greatly, but basically he realized that the form wasn't important. It was the intent behind it that was needed. And because the only form that she would accept it in is something that fit with her perspective, you know, he began reading at each visit a little bit from the Bible, and very soon after she was, you know, released from the hospital, and you know, so basically the bottom line of that is, you know, don't be so attached to the form, but just, you know, do what you feel can be the most helpful, guided by your inner guidance.
Exactly, and that's compassion.
Right.
That is what compassion is, and it's not because of fear. Yeah. You're not doing it because of fear. You're doing it because of love,
right.
And that makes a huge, huge, huge difference. So, you know, if you, speaking of that kind of thing, how many people do you know who have families who are fundamentalists who are in terror that their loved one is going to go to hell? And so, compassionately, what they're trying to do is, you know, force you to to convert, so that you'll be saved, because they're in such fear for your mortal soul or whatever. Well, you know, that sounds really radical and sounds like, wow, I would never do that. And yet, oh my God, how often do I do that? And especially to Course in Miracles students who are, you know, saying things like, you know, well, you know, this world will be here. This world was created by God. And I want to say, no, 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 you know, don't think that way. You're ruining your thoughts.
And of course, our investment in wanting to change other people and proselytizing, that's all basically a brilliant ego strategy to keep fear around in the mind. And, because it's based on the idea that something could be lacking and out of place in perfect oneness.
Exactly. Yeah. So then these are the blocks.
Yeah.
My belief in this is a block.
Yeah.
To my awareness of love's presence. My judgment of you and the way that you do it is a block. My judgment that you're going to suffer if I do or don't do certain things is a block. These are the things that I'm looking at in my life, that are very personal and have to do with every aspect of my life. And when I look at them and I see how it is that I'm doing it to myself, then, you know, it's really easy to recognize that I do need to practice that forgiveness. And again, I'm going to fix it. Oh my God, how many times have I gone through, okay, I'm going to stop doing that now. I'm going to fix that now. I'm going to start doing this instead. Instead of, Holy Spirit, I'm thinking wrongly here. Uh-huh. You know, you do it for me, you know, and if I'm going to stop doing it, I'll stop. And if that's what's supposed to happen, I'm supposed to start doing something else or eating certain things or anything. It's the Holy Spirit that I have to go to as an advisor and stop advising myself on how to be and what should be and how things are. Those are incredible blocks. My own thinking is the block to my awareness of love's presence. And if I could just let that go and let him think for me, then I will be fully aware. And when I do let that go, I am aware that, that, you know, love is here and it is not negotiable. So.
Yeah. There's nothing that we could do to undo it. I mean, so it's a non-negotiable truth. Should we read the last four paragraphs really quickly?
Okay. I'm thinking, Bruce, and you know, you may not want to do this, but since we already do a meditation at 10 o'clock, we don't necessarily have to do one at maybe we do. I don't know. Anyway, we can go on.
Anyway. I'm not attached to the forum, and that was only a suggestion, you know. So
No, because I don't want to skim through this stuff. And
okay, sure.
I really enjoy this conversation because it brings a lot of things up for me.
Yeah, me too. You know, absolutely. Otherwise, I wouldn't be doing it because it's, you know, and the fact that, you know, it's a dialogue, each of us reminds the others of things that's like, oh, yeah, that's right. I could apply this.
Exactly. I love it. Okay, so the next paragraph says, Lesson 67 tells us that love created us like itself, and that if love created you like itself, this self, with a capital S, must be in you, and somewhere in your mind, it is there for you to find. Oh my God. Mm-hmm. When you read this, did you say, oh my God? I didn't, I just said, oh yeah, that's pretty, that's nice. But now I'm really getting, oh, it's in me. It really is in me to be found. And this is not a metaphor. Synonym or homonym or any of those things.
Yeah, that's, I think, another thing that has been really helpful to me is in those more mindful moments, I realized that the idea of metaphor, because we usually think of the abstract as being unreal. At least that's kind of how I grew up thinking that, you know, if something is abstract or conceptual, you know, mental, then it's not as real as form. Well, I'm beginning to think, you know, maybe we got this exactly opposite. And that the world of metaphor is really the world of form. And that it's because we have everything backwards, using ego's dictums and it's propaganda as our guidelines for what we, you know, what we believe, then space and time and bodies and individuality and all that stuff is basically a metaphor for the tiny man idea. It's basically a symbolic representation of a silly, silly, forgivable idea that we collectively made up and then decided to divide our one individuality into these seemingly multiple individualities. and made up a whole world to reinforce it, to hide out in from a crime we never committed. And wow, talk about a sci-fi virtual reality, you know, thriller plot gone awry. Yeah.
But everything is a clue.
Yeah, everything is a clue that we could go beyond the metaphor to the reality of the mind, where there is peace beyond anything we could imagine there. And that's what you were just talking about. Love created you like itself, so the self must be in you. That peace, that joyous awareness, that eternal exhilaration has to be, the best we could describe it, I guess, you know, in various ways, has to be in our mind and has been there all along. So.
Yep. And so how now do I use from that perspective now, how do I use my mind to discover these things? Mm-hmm. And how I've been using my mind to discover these things is to look at what is the purpose of this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what is the purpose? And it may seem really simplistic, but, you know, asking the question, what is the purpose of this computer? You know, I made this computer and I projected it here and I put it in front of me so that I could communicate with Bruce. And the purpose mm-hmm. of it is to say that Bruce is far away from me. And therefore, in order for me to communicate with him, I have to have all these devices.
Right.
They're all a symbol of the blocks that I put between me and the awareness of love's presence. And I don't hate them because of that, because obviously I made them for a purpose, but also to know that if I were not wanting to have this division, then I wouldn't need this computer and you and I would not need words. There would be no you and I to need those words because we would know our own self as one mind. So everything that I'm thinking, doing this, you know, I always say this chair that my butt's sitting in, I made the butt, I made the chair. Why? Because I wanted to keep myself as separate from you as I could. That's how we maintain this world of separation. And the guilt that comes from knowing that I actually do know that I'm doing it, whether I'm aware consciously or not, I do know that I'm doing it. The guilt that comes from that is what keeps it in place. And if I can just look at it and release that guilt, see it differently, then there is no need for anything to be kept in place. There's no need. And so anyway, I'm going to go on because I could go on and on and on with that.
It's a mad metaphor, isn't it? Yes.
It's crazy. So if love created yourself, where the heck is it? Who am I and why? yet nowhere in that lesson 67, does Jesus define love. But he does talk about our need to undo what we've put in its place. In the very next lesson, Jesus teaches us about the cause of the almost irreparable damage we have done to our minds, grievances. All right, you who are created by love like itself can hold no grievances and know yourself. For he who holds grievances denies he was created by love, and his creator has become fearful to him in his dream of hate. And so here's another perspective of exactly the same thing that we were just talking about. Another perspective of it is that the thing that, you know, I said guilt is the thing that holds everything in place. Grievances are the thing that holds everything in place. And grievances is even a better way of looking at it, because that is actually guilt that I am actively holding on to and projecting.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Guilt seems like it's just like, oh, I'm a victim. But grievance says, I'm holding on to it. I'm using it as a weapon.
Yeah, whatever works for people, you know, is a mechanism for getting back to the mind is fair game, because, you know, for some people, guilt may seem, you know, too vague in general, if they're not, you know, if there's nothing specific that comes to mind. But I think most people, if they're honest, can look at the course of any given day and think of all the thousands of things that they would rather have different.
Yes.
And that they're to some degree upset about. And I think that's, like you say, where grievances can be really, really a helpful mechanism as a classroom of looking at our investment in the 3D reality, that as the world calls reality, and seeing where we've made big deals where none exist.
Exactly. And even little deals, as in, are you ever comfortable? Are you ever comfortable, no matter where you are, no matter what you're doing? Are you ever comfortable? We're so uncomfortable that we actually make ourselves go unconscious.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Hours at a time, because we're...
How about lifetimes at a time?
I mean, we're never comfortable. And yeah. every bit of uncomfortability is a grievance to me. You know, I'm pissed about it. No, I don't like it that my knee hurts or my back hurts or that my eyes are bad or that it's too hot or too cold or that my coffee's cold or all these things are just irritating.
Yeah, yeah. And even as, you know, younger people that seem to have less bodily issues, you know, there's still psychological things going on. There's still, I you know, the world's polluted or they're, you know, they're not getting enough to eat or, you know.
Yes.
Pick any aspect of life in this world, and it's all fair game for looking at how we have avoided in so many different ways the curriculum of the Holy Spirit, which says that a tranquil mind is not a small gift. You know, we forget that the peace that we're going for. And we will all reach that because we're already there. We're just dreaming that it takes time. That is more than phenomenally wonderful. It's just, it's beyond our ego's comprehension, which is why we made up an ego, because we thought we didn't deserve to comprehend it.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, really, this is, talk about a guilt trip.
Yeah.
We've done insane things. So okay. So
lucid guilt trip.
Yeah, lucid guilt trip. So if we deny love, which holding grievances does, how can we know love? Yet how can we fail to know it when we have totally forgiven everyone? This is similar to Jesus telling us that we can never understand the concept of a oneness joined as one, as long as we think we are separate from one another. Mm-hmm. And that's from text chapter 25. So yeah, as long as we think we're separate, we can never understand this concept of oneness joined as one. So, how do we get out of believing that we're separate? You know, it takes forgiveness, this process.
Exactly.
So, do you want to read the next paragraph?
Sure.
We can just scoot through these and take another 15 minutes or so if you want.
Sure, you bet. Again, in lesson 127, Jesus helps us realize the consequences of seeing our identity in the context of bodily existence in the world. And there's a quote from workbook lesson 127. What the world believes was made to hide love's meaning. What the world believes was made to hide love's meaning and to keep it dark and secret. There is not one principle the world upholds, but violates the truth of what love is and what you are as well. Wow, that's a lot of propaganda going on here, you know. Everything that we believe about the world was designed to obscure the unlimited peaceful truth of what we are. Unlimited tranquility in the mind, yeah.
And we have to question everything in the world. That's why when Jesus says things like, I'm under no laws but God's, mm-hmm. he's saying question the laws you think you're under.
Yeah. Right.
You know, the law that says that you shouldn't wear white after Labor Day, or the law that says,
huh?
They don't have that law anymore, but you know, it used to be a law in the world, and you, they would laugh at you if you were wearing white after Labor Day.
That one. I'm a fugitive from that law.
That must be a 50s thing. Or the law that says, you know, you shouldn't spit on the sidewalk, or the law that says that. There's a lot that you shouldn't sing at the table, or
I'm guilty. Yeah, oh man, I'm
what are these laws? You know, that we believe in, and Joel Goldsmith talks about this a lot, very eloquently, about all the things that we put ourselves under, other than the power of God.
Yeah.
And things like, you know, my horoscope, or the, you know, on Sunday we must go to church, or, you know, whatever the law is that you think, or on Lent we can't eat chocolate, or, you know, there's all kinds of laws that we make up and we believe in, and then we punish ourselves if we don't follow them. But, you know, here's what he's saying. what the world believes was made to hide love's meaning. So all those things are made to hide love. They're blocks to love. Anyway, I'll shut up and let you read on.
Okay. You're right. It's all about obfuscation and hiding and deceiving and denying. And so we have to deny the denial of truth and to get back to the truth. And that's the not know of the Course. Okay. So it is not difficult to discern from this what we have to do to restore our awareness of love's meaning to our minds. And that is what Jesus spells out for us in this lesson, remarking that, quote, there is no better use for time than this, unquote. And that's, again, from workbook lesson 127, and that's in paragraph 7 of that one. We ourselves as decision-making minds are the authors of all the values we find in the world, and our motivation in producing them was to replace what we disowned, ourself. Now we need but reverse that and allow God's gifts to replace what we made. That's from paragraph 8 in that same lesson 127. Love, then, will be our only experience, because love is the only reality in our minds. Well, that's not how we see it, but that's the truth of what our eternal mind has in it. So, do you want to read the next one?
Sure. So in the end, as Jesus states at the beginning, love's meaning cannot be taught or learned, because it is what we are. He says he can teach us to remember who we truly are, and adds, quote, no course whose purpose is to teach you this could fail to emphasize that there can never be a difference in what you really are and what love is. Love's meaning is your own and shared by God himself, for what you are is what he is. And that, again, is from Workbook 127. Our lives must therefore be dedicated to uncovering our self-deception and the means we use to sustain that deception. With that undone, love's meaning will blaze in our minds, and all questioning simply dissolve into nothingness. So all we're doing is uncovering how we're fooling ourselves. Mm-hmm. And when you think about it, how can I fool myself? And yet you know you do it all the time. I know I do it all the time.
Oh, yeah. And I think that's where the true humility is, in recognizing the arrogance of the ego to postulate this preposterous idea that we are these separate individuals. And that's the arrogance of thinking that we could do better than God. We could branch out on our own, make something better. And so we made up a whole universe of form in order to attempt this. And forgetting that this was just a blip in our mind that really never happened. And we're just, you know, we're just enthralled with the echoes of the echoes of an experiment gone wrong that was just a conceptual idea that we thought could be possible, but it never could be. So we were protected from that experiment by the fact that, you know, love doesn't know anything unlike itself. And so therefore, anything that's not perfect love and kindness doesn't exist. But we're so invested in that dream that seemed to have continued, that we forget that nothing happened. And so when we read statements like these, you know, love's meaning will blaze into our minds and all questioning simply dissolves into nothing. Well, that sounds great. You know, it's like, wow, sure, let's do it. But doesn't it sound a little far-fetched? Doesn't it sound a bit far-fetched? I mean, but yet that's the reality. And we're so far down the ego's rabbit hole and we've so identified with these thugs and these hoodlum characters that have thought they beat up God and left him for dead
well, that's what we think.
And fled fugitive style into a nightmarish dream. That we think that, you know, there's nothing left there. You know, we trash God. You know, that creation is over and done. Well, no, not so fast, amigo. You know, we didn't do anything to that perfect oneness, but we did make up a dream that's so convincing that it seems like we pulled it off. And that's why, you know, those, you know, statements like that seem like pleasant fiction at times. And yet the truth is we're at home in God and dreaming of exile.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But that is not our experience.
No.
And so what is the thing that's keeping, and this is what people are always saying, well, I'm not experiencing that. No, right. You're not, because you're all believing in all this other crap.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, as long as you want to keep up this deception, and that's an insult to the ego. That's
right.
An insult to people, to tell people you're fooling yourself. And they'll say, well, to speak for yourself, you know, well, yeah, I'm speaking for myself. I'm fooling myself that I'm talking to you because there is no you and there is no me. And these are things that we believe and people think that's an insult too. And it is to the ego, but
sure.
Only the ego can be insulted.
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, this is the thing. You got to give up and look at the pride that the ego has in trying to keep these things going and make excuses for itself and for its poor behavior.
Yeah.
And so you got to blame God. It's got to blame, you know, everyone else for being, you know, able to do this. Why did you even let me do this? What kind of God would even let me do a thing like this? You know,
really?
He's a moron, you know.
Yeah, how come he gave me permission to play hooky? Well, no, he didn't. You know, that another metaphor that comes to mind that's a favorite one that kind of speaks to what you're just saying, Lynn, as far as the, you know, the do it my way ethic and sanity of the ego and the pride involved in that is, you know, it's kind of like the ego's strategy is to never get up to the top of Everest, but make a big show and a lot of bluster and, you know, like Shakespeare said, you know, it's sound and fury signifying nothing, you know, but it's basically a seek but do not find strategy. So it, you know, we hire Sherpas and then we, you know, get all these elaborate provisions with all the state of the art climbing gear and, you know, ropes and ladders and rock hammers and carabiners and all that stuff. And by golly, we're out there and, you know, freezing our buns off, you know, climbing up Everest and enduring the winds and the temperatures but Holy Spirit says, psst, psst, hey, over here, just look a few degrees this way and you'll see this escalator up the back side of Everest. And not only that, it's a heated escalator that's covered, you know, so if, you know, if there's a blizzard, it's nice and warm and you can just, and oh, and there's oxygen, you know, it's a pressurized, warm pressurized escalator. But you know, our egos don't want any of that, so we don't even notice that there's this wonderful escalator that the Holy Spirit has for us. And the only reason there's an escalator is because we think it takes time, and you know, we've already been at the top of Everest all along. But
right, we think there's a place. Yeah,
we think there's a place we have to get to.
Yeah,
but within that context, you know, it seems like that, you know, a pretty reasonable alternative, and that escalator is the forgiveness of all the specifics, grabbing each little you know, crazy idea and of the egos and snatching it away and saying, okay, I got this now. Sorry, ego, you can't have this one. I'm going to use this for forgiveness. I'm going to build a classroom instead of a prison out of this instead.
Exactly. So it's every exception. Yeah. Every exception that you think you can make as to why it can't be.
Mm-hmm.
That's the things you got to let the Holy Spirit take it.
Yeah.
If you don't understand how can it be that I can live and not be in a body? You know, and believe it or not, even though we all say I'm not a body and I'm free and death is not real, we still believe that if somebody came and shot this head, you know, with a bullet, that I would leave the body and no longer be in existence. I don't know what I'd do. I don't know where I'd be, but I think I'm connected to it. And so, all of this stuff is, and then everything that has to do with it. You know, if I don't have my inhaler, it's impacting on my being. If I don't eat, you know, the proper nutrition, or I don't exercise, or, you know, I get your germs, you attack me with germs, all these things, I'm still believing very clearly that I'm going to get sick. As much as I've studied this course and as much as I've worked on forgiveness of these things, because I haven't really looked at the reality of what I think is happening here. I haven't really looked at the way I'm deceiving myself. Mm-hmm. And I've just, you know, I've you know, practiced, but without, it's like you're practicing without the instrument.
Yeah. What you just said reminded me of another, I think, crucially important point that we all take a long time to learn because we're so invested in the dream we made. You know, the ego's difficult Everest route rather than the Holy Spirit's, you know, heated, pressurized escalator. and that's, you know, the idea that we need to somehow fix the dream. Well, no, the escalator that the Holy Spirit provides doesn't fix the dream. It doesn't make Everest go away. But what it does is it gives us a way of looking at it that is not one filled with grievances and strife. But it's a shift in the mind. It's not a physical thing at all. And there's a quote I think we might have mentioned in a previous conversation that if I'm remembering correctly, I'm going to paraphrase it again as usual. It's, your job is not to undo the illusions, but to escape from them. You know, you're not here to change the illusion, but you're here to escape from them. In other words, another phrase of Ken's that I like is, you know, when you realize you're in the desert, the thing to do is to leave. You don't try to fix the desert.
Right. You know? Well, that it says that in the course.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
go ahead.
So, that's it. Exactly. And if you're thinking that, you know, we're here to try to make, fix things, as in, you know, the election or the environment or, my hair or any of those things, he said earlier in this particular section here, it really is a waste of our time.
Yeah.
You know, we're using time for something other than what it's for.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you want to read the last paragraph now?
Sure, sure. Jesus speaks of love and oneness in the same breath, and obviously they are equated as expressed in this lesson as well as other places. As it is one itself, it looks on all as one. Its meaning lies in oneness, and it must elude the mind that thinks of it as partial or in part. That is a special love. And that's still from workbook lesson 127. This is now being paragraph 3, sentences 2 and 3. So, yeah, it has to, anything that's part, you know, in we're talking about politics, since this is an election year, the partisan, party, partial, you know, and I think the word partial is a big clue, you know, because you say I'm partial to this or partial to that. And that's usually when we've identified with the ego and go beyond having a preference that is not a big deal either way to something that we're going to get upset about if we don't have, you know, our way, which is the, you know, ultimately turns out to be the brutal ascent of Everest rather than the the easy one up the escalator.
My fingers are numb.
Really, really. Love is all-inclusive and extends itself to infinity without limit. Another indication of what our curriculum must be, the undoing of all forms of separation, judgment, special love, exclusion, separate interests, and asking Jesus or the Holy Spirit for help in focusing our lives now on learning to see everyone as sharing the same purpose and the same identity. Of such is the function of forgiveness and the miracle. That's it. We just have to forgive ourselves for dreaming it up. Forgiveness is an earthly form of love, which, as it is in heaven, has no form. Yet what is needed here is given here as it is needed. In this form, you can fulfill your function even here, although what love will mean to you when formlessness has been restored to you is great still. Is that supposed to be greater still? Well, anyway, it doesn't matter.
It should be greater.
I think it's supposed to be greater, but the idea being that we're clueless as to how wonderful the reality of our being is because we're so invested in the surreality of the fake self that we made up. Because we think we're going to get mileage out of it. We think that somehow we're going to get an award or some kind of recognition for the martyrdom approach of going up Everest, the bitter, cruel and tough way up the blizzardy side, you know.
Oh, and there are people who actually believe that suffering is virtuous. Yeah. And in fact, I believed it my whole life. Goodness, didn't Jesus do it? And didn't he, make a grand suffering for all of us? Mm-hmm. Of course, then any suffering I do is going to be helpful to everyone else.
Yeah. Of course.
Telling me your suffering has no meaning. you're doing this to yourself. That's quite a blow. Mm-hmm. I've certainly invested a lot in suffering over the years.
Oh, haven't we all? I mean, if we're honest, haven't we all? And that's really what the Course asks us to look at, and very gently, is to see, and one of Ken's audios where he talks about Workbook Lesson 182, he says, the point is not for us to suffer. The point is to realize that we have been suffering and to look at it without condemnation and say, do you really want to continue to suffer? And be honest about the fact that we are miserable to the degree that we identify with our separate selves, our partial selves. How could that make us happy if there's something missing?
Exactly. And the answer, of course, is that it can't. And so give it up. Quit even trying. And again, he brings up the asking Jesus or the Holy Spirit for help. Mm-hmm. Man, how I'm still reluctant to do that, even though, I know that it works only every time. I still think I can figure it out myself and still try to make plans and still try to, when I heard my husband was going to lose his job, I started looking at, how can I get, go on Upwork and see if I can find some, do some writing or, do this or that. I'm already making plans instead of saying, Holy Spirit, what help me, help me first off to not be in fear and help me, to know when to act, how to act, what to do. Not that, Spirit is going to, give me direction, go here and get this job, but because the script is already written, it's done. This is not happening tomorrow. This happened long ago.
Uh-huh.
And so the only choice really I have is to relax through the process. It's like when you're in labor and you may not know this, but when you're in labor and you know, when you go into labor and you're going through all this agony and pain, that it will end. Mm-hmm. It will not be on forever and ever. It will end. And when it ends, you will have a baby. So, or maybe more. But this is what it's like. Just knowing it's over. you know, the baby's here already. You know, I just have to get through this part where I believe that I'm suffering. Yeah. And so I just have to ask for help this moment, this instant now, when I think that there's something that can go wrong. This moment, this instant now, when I'm afraid for the future, which doesn't exist and never will exist, because it never did exist. You know, these are all concepts, but when I, you know, put it to myself and I recognize, yeah, that book was written a long time ago. The end is done, and nothing, you're not going to go back and change it, even if it seems like it's happening tomorrow. I'm not going to change what's happening tomorrow because nothing is happening. We're just in a story. Man, that's the hardest thing to really see. And to believe and just then allow my mind to be at ease throughout the process, because I know that it will be over and that it's already over. And, you know, we all lived happily ever after.
Yeah. And there's no order of difficulty in the seeming dark nights or overcasts of the soul, right? I mean, it's all the same thing, even though sometimes things seem far more challenging or difficult than other times. But it's any form of suffering is basically something that we can undo by forgiving the dreamer, and by identifying with the dreamer, by forgiving ourselves for our complicity in it. We see that the it that we're forgiving never happened. That's where it actually starts to click, and we see, oh my gosh, I've been making such a big deal out of nothing. Much ado about nothing, as Shakespeare said.
Exactly. So, well, thank you, Bruce.
Thank you, Lynn. And I'll start our conversations. Fun. Yeah. So, we just want to mention that for the folks that are in the Colorado area in June, there's still places left at the Weekend of Freedom Retreat. We mentioned the Las Vegas one and the Colorado Springs events coming up also. But for people that don't know about that, there's in Estes Park, June 16th through the 19th, the Weekend of Freedom Retreat that's happening there. And Gary Renard, Cindy Laura Renard, David Hoffmeister, Lori Coburn, Craig Villarubia, a bunch of folks. Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. And I'm even going to share a little bit myself. So hope you can avail yourself of that if that works out for your schedule, et cetera. So,
well, exactly. I think I'm going to be there. I'm pretty sure that I am.
Okay.
But, you know, just, you know, how that comes about. Always a mystery. Regina's already told me she'll drive me, so okay. I have a way to get there. And
I was kind of doing the same thing with trusting about the Las Vegas one. I thought, well, if it happens, it happens. And I won the ticket yesterday. So
I'm so thrilled about that. Because, like I said, I'll be there. Jennifer Nuhulu's going to be there.
Good.
She's going with me and lots of other great folks. And, you know, some amazing collaborations. That's what I'm seeing here. Yay. All right. Thank you, Bruce Rawls, and thank you all for joining us here
thanks
at the House of the Rising Sun. See you next week.
So much love.